Officials report more missile strikes in Ukraine's Odessa region.
7 buildings were destroyed in the recreation center in Zatoka. And this is in addition to 15 private buildings that were damaged.
Plus, what would it mean if Russia moves ahead with its expected annexation of controlled Ukrainian territory?
The political, military, economic, social, and so on consequences of a prolonged Russian military occupation of southern and eastern Ukraine would be devastating to the long-term viability of the Ukrainian state.
And later in the program, as Ukrainians seek refuge from the war, many take their pets. Today is Wednesday, August 17th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine says Russian forces continued firing upon the Odessa region, destroying a recreation center and several private buildings. From Kyiv, Anna Chernikova shares the latest updates on the ground.
Today, over the night, it was an attack by Russian forces on the Odessa region, and to be more precise, on the village of Zatoka. And Zatoka is one of the main touristic destination in Odessa region. It always been, but after the annexation of Crimea, it became even more. So it's huge and very important touristic destination in Ukraine in general. And today we hear reports that 7 buildings were destroyed in the recreation center in Zatoka. And this is in addition to 15 private buildings that were damaged. Currently, officials of the region are reporting about 4 injured citizens, but rescue operation is ongoing, so the number might change and we might get more details and more information later on.
I also want to follow up with you because there were reports from both Russian authorities and Ukrainian authorities about those explosions that were taking place in Crimea. What have we learned since then?
In general, what we hear that Russian forces accuse Ukrainian forces in sabotage. This is when we talk about yesterday accidents in Jankoy and next to Simferopol. According to Saki, the first attack that happened a bit earlier, Russian forces just reported that it was an explosion inside, and they didn't specifically provided any details on that. So they're just claiming it was a fire inside because of certain not correct actions by the staff. But Ukrainian forces put it quite clear that Crimea is considered by Ukraine as a territory of Ukraine. And yesterday, the head of President Administration of President Zelensky office, Mr. Yermak, said that Ukrainian forces will definitely work on liberating all territories. But today we received British intelligence report on these attacks. And according to British intelligence, they say that Jankoy, together with Gvardiyske, which is next to Simferopol, are home to two of the most important Russian military airfields in Crimea. And Jankoy in particular is also a key road and rail hub that plays an important role in supporting Russian operation in southern Ukraine. So basically, British intelligence claiming that these two places are basically the key of Russian operations in southern Ukraine. And they also say that after the recent explosions in the occupied Crimea, the command of the Russian Federation is most likely to be pretty much concerned about the obvious deterioration of security on the peninsula. Also, British intelligence report that the ships of the Black Sea Fleet of Russia continue to take an extremely defensive positions, and patrolling that they are doing is usually limited to the water area within the visibility of the Crimean coast.
And just to back up just a second, while you mentioned that Ukraine has hinted that they may be responsible for the attacks on the Crimean Peninsula over the past few days, they have stopped short, in fact, coming out and explicitly saying that they are responsible. One last topic I wanted to speak to you about. I understand there have been some explosions, possibly at a Russian commandant's office in Melitopol. What can you share about that?
Just today, we received a confirmation about Melitopol explosion that was heard near the commandant's office of the Russian forces in the central of Melitopol, which is now occupied by Russian forces. It's in the Zaporizhia region. We do not have details about this particular explosion, so we don't have details about casualties or damages. But according to the mayor of Melitopol, Ivan Fedorov, the explosions were quite huge. What also was reported by Ivan Fedorov, the mayor of Melitopol, that yesterday, apparently, Ukrainian forces also made certain actions and explosions were heard next to the electricity substation. And after that, the broadcast of the Russian television was cut.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
As life in the Russian-occupied town of Kherson proves to be increasingly restrictive, more and more residents are fleeing to other parts of Ukraine. From the Associated Press, Karen Chamas reports.
Kherson was the first city to fall after Russia's February invasion of Ukraine. At first, many residents took to the streets to protest the occupation, shouting, "Kherson is Ukraine." Kherson resident Vladimir Zhdanov said the resistance was strong until the Russians started to crack down on them. Then people started leaving. Activists who were somewhere in the city center, they went to protest for quite a long time. My friends went out every day until April. There were fewer and fewer of them. Then the Russians dispersed them and fired both noise and gas projectiles. Zhdanov said the change in his town forced him to flee to Kyiv. You lived your life, built some relationships, in one moment everything is turned upside down. You don't know what will happen tomorrow. So for us, it's like being under a hood, and it's very painful. I'm Karen Chamas.
In July, White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said the U.S. intelligence reports indicated that Russia may try to annex parts of Ukraine that it controlled.
Russia is beginning to roll out a version of what you could call an annexation playbook, very similar to the one we saw in 2014. Already, Russia is installing illegitimate proxy officials in the areas of Ukraine that are under its control. And we know their next moves. First, these proxy officials will arrange sham referenda on joining Russia. Then, Russia will use those sham referenda as a basis to try to claim annexation of sovereign Ukrainian territory. The Russian government is reviewing detailed plans to purportedly annex a number of regions in Ukraine, including Kherson, Zaporizhia, all of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts.
While Moscow has not annexed those areas as of yet, analysts say there are still indications that that may take place at some point in the future. In part three of my conversation with Catherine Lawlor, senior analyst with the Institute for the Study of War, I asked her about the implications of Moscow trying to carry out that process.
So we initially thought that Russian forces would hold these sham elections on September 11th, which is the day that Russia conducts its elections for local and gubernatorial voting across the country. But they've actually set conditions to annex this territory at any time. They've planned for online voting in areas without internet. They've planned door-to-door surveys conducted by armed soldiers. There's no chance that the referendum is going to be free or fair. Whenever it happens, that outcome is preordained. And so ultimately, the Russian annexation of occupied Ukrainian territory, as with their annexation of Crimea, is illegitimate and somewhat geopolitically meaningless. The ongoing brutality of the Russian occupation is the important part, and that's already happening. And we need to keep that brutality at the front of our minds. Occupation officials are forcing Ukrainian civilians to accept Russian passports, to use the Russian ruble, to undergo these filtration measures that are reminiscent of the Second World War. I mean, children are being separated from their families. Russian forces may be forcibly conscripting Ukrainian civilians to fight on Russia's behalf. Those are far more important and damaging to Ukraine and to European security generally than the referenda will be. But the political, military, economic, social, and so on, consequences of a prolonged Russian military occupation of southern and eastern Ukraine would be devastating to the long-term viability of the Ukrainian state. But I don't think that the performative drama of annexation will change the on-the-ground realities of that brutal occupation. And the only way to avoid that undermining of Ukrainian statehood is for Ukraine to retake its sovereign territory and to liberate its citizens. And Ukrainian forces can only do that with additional global support.
To follow up on that, I mean, President Zelensky has said that, you know, the war began with the annexation of Crimea. It will end with its liberation. But with Russia entrenched in those areas, you know, how difficult in your assessment does that make in coming up with either some kind of ceasefire, some kind of way to end the conflict so that the brutality on the ground lessens?
It's really tough. And I think one of the reasons Ukraine is not pushing for a ceasefire right now is because that would entrench and allow the Russians to entrench their occupation of these areas and make them harder to push out. The longer they spend there, the more defenses they can build up. And Crimea is a good example of that. The other thing is the longer that Russian forces occupy Ukrainian territory, the more they can undermine sort of the mechanisms of statehood in that area. So they've already, since the war began, targeted Ukrainian mayors and other local government officials for arrest or assassination. They have forced people to give up their Ukrainian documents. Just that alone, the paperwork involved in reconstituting governance in these areas will be spectacular. But I think that's part of their playbook, is making this area more and more difficult to govern. And in the meantime, undermining any Ukrainian identity in that area by force if necessary. So it won't be easy. And I think Ukraine is very unwilling to consider negotiations from this position where Russian forces still occupy such large swaths of their territory that are not only fundamental parts of Ukraine's sovereign territory, but also economically important and defensively important. One of the worst case scenarios for Ukraine is that the conflict settles in along these current front lines and maybe there's a ceasefire for a while. That doesn't mean the war is over. That means Russia has time to reconstitute its forces, to rebuild its arsenals, and then to launch its next invasion from these front lines, which are less defensible in some ways than the previous front lines of the conflict that we saw after the war settled into more of a stagnant state after 2014. And that's the most dangerous scenario for Ukrainian statehood, because it's pretty clear that Russian President Putin has not given up his goal of destroying the Ukrainian state. He failed to take Kyiv, he failed to destroy the government, but he has not demonstrated that he is willing to set aside that goal. He's also very patient, and settling into these front lines is a way to ensure that Russia can reconstitute and can launch an additional offensive. Whether that's a month from now, a year from now, it doesn't really matter. Ukraine has to keep pushing at this stage.
Catherine Lawler is a senior analyst with the Institute for the Study of War. Catherine, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. As mentioned on yesterday's program, during the first 15 days of August, more than 560,000 metric tons of food have thus far been moved out of Ukraine's ports on the Black Sea. Also, the first World Food Program vessel left the port city of Odessa yesterday for Africa. Marianne Ward is the Deputy Emergency Coordinator for the World Food Program in Ukraine. She was there and spoke with VOA's Carol Van Dam.
Okay, so it is leaving the Odessa port of Pivdenyi, which is one of the three Odessa ports. And this is actually the first ship to leave that particular port. And then we're very pleased that it's a humanitarian ship leading the way. And it is on its way to Djibouti, where the cargo will then be transshipped to Ethiopia for our operations there. It'll take about 2 weeks for it to arrive. There will be more shipments. We hope one, it's the first of many, to, of course, go to other ports in the Horn of Africa and then, of course, the Middle East and other places because, you know, Ukraine's agricultural bounty fed 400 million people across the world last year. So there are lots of places that need the food of Ukraine.
And you mentioned the 400 million people that were fed by this grain last year. Does that mean those 400 million people didn't get grain and are suffering this year?
Are basically suffering this year because not nearly the amount of grain that, you know, left ports normally last year has left the ports this year after the closing at the end of February.
So just if you would step back a little and tell me what it was like to be right next to that ship.
I mean, really, the biggest emotion was just joy to see a ship leaving that port for the first time in 6 months. You know, it's a port that's been closed, even though they were, you know, supporting the employees and everything. We weren't really quite sure when they, you know, when they flipped the switch, if all systems would really be go, but they really were. So, you know, watching the grain just flow into the holds and watching, you know, the sailors getting everything ready to move. It was just like, you know, normal operations, which is really what we need is normal operations. And again, I just think, really, really proud that it was a humanitarian ship to get that particular port up and moving and functional again.
How many countries are facing acute food insecurity now? And how many countries are at the threshold of famine?
Technically, we've got about 20 countries right now across the globe that are on what we would call the famine watch list. So that is just an incredibly, probably a record number of countries around the globe. So the
Are most of those countries in Africa?
I would say probably, but certainly countries, you know, in the Middle East and elsewhere that are undergoing, you know, crises such in Yemen, Afghanistan. It takes a lot of things to cause a famine. And unfortunately, many countries are teetering on the brink right now.
I mean, how important is this shipment?
Well, I recently came from Sudan, which is a country that is very much reliant on wheat and other commodities coming out of Ukraine. And I mean, the price of wheat, which essentially goes into the price of bread, I mean, has gone up at least double. You know, you're talking month on month increases since February just goes up and up and up and up. And in fact, the result is that 40% of the country, so 40% of the population is now facing acute food insecurity, a record number of people that they've never seen basically, you know, in practically the history of Sudan. And part of that is because of the high price of basic foodstuffs such as grains.
That's the World Food Program's Deputy Emergency Coordinator in Ukraine, Marianne Ward, speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. When film director Elisa Kovalenko signed up to fight for Ukraine, she says she was driven by outrage over Russia's invasion of her home and memories of a sexual assault that she survived during battles with Moscow-backed separatists 8 years earlier. Reuters' Angela Johnston has her story.
Filmmaker Elisa Kovalenko now shoots with a gun instead of her camera. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February, she volunteered to fight on the Eastern Front. She says she was outraged about the invasion and flooded with memories of a sexual assault she survived 8 years ago.
After it was 2014, I promised that if war will like grow up and it will like cover all Ukraine, then I will fight not with my camera but with a gun.
Kovalenko said she was working on a film in the Donetsk region in 2014 when she was stopped at a separatist checkpoint, interrogated, and accused of being a sniper. She alleges a Russian officer tried to rape her.
I was not afraid of anything after it. It's like it was the highest level of, like, fear. And even when I went to the war, I didn't have this, like, I was not so afraid about war.
Russian authorities did not immediately respond to requests for comment about her account.
Moscow regularly denied sending troops to separatists at the time and has dismissed sexual violence allegations by its forces as lies and propaganda. Kovalenko has now spent months under shelling on the front line, far from her husband and young son in France. She also lost a close friend.
You feel like it's somebody from your family who died. So for me, it was most terrible experience in my life.
Moscow calls the invasion a special military operation to demilitarize its neighbor and root out nationalists. Ukraine and its Western allies say that is a baseless pretext for an unprovoked war of aggression.
Angela Johnston from Reuters News brought us that report. And finally, as Ukrainians seek refuge any way that they can, both inside and outside of the country, many are taking their pets with them wherever they go. Maxim Moskakoloff rounds us out today.
The war forced more than 13 million Ukrainians to leave their homes, according to the United Nations, with more than 8 million internally displaced and some 5 million heading to neighboring countries to seek refuge. Many of these people have pets with them. Greater Good Charities is trying to help both people and their pets.
We set up a large network of partners to distribute product, both for humans and for pets, in neighboring countries for refugees and then for internally displaced people in Ukraine.
Greater Good Charities helps organize food stations at border crossings, in shelters and refugee centers, and aids with the evacuation process of both people and pets. The organization also hands out the so-called good packs, kits filled with basic necessities. Kyiv native Vlada spent a few weeks in a basement together with her family, trying to stay safe during the shelling. But she realized she couldn't stay idle any longer.
So I started to find a way to collect some food and some money, just actual food and money to buy food, to buy medicine, just to help another people. And it made me such busy and tired that I at least could sleep, because we couldn't sleep like first months at all.
Greater Good Charities supported Vlada's volunteer efforts and now provides her with funding and sends her food items and pet food. In late February, a flood of scared Ukrainians started spilling over into Poland, and Martina Maciejewska, who would soon become a Greater Good Charities employee, headed to the border to volunteer helping refugees.
Everyone is different. Everyone needs a different kind of support. Let's say some people just needed mental support. Some people needed a direction. Some people needed food because they didn't eat for days.
Today, she helps coordinate Greater Good's work in Poland and neighboring countries.
Greater Good Charities funded over 7 million meals through local partners and food banks. We also provided 500 tons of pet food.
According to Horton, the main challenge for the organization is time. The longer the war drags on, the less attention it gets from the international community.
People need food. People need supplies, medical supplies. Pets need food. And so it is really, really important that we remain supportive.
Greater Good Charities helps not only pets, but also animal shelters, stray animals, and wild animals in danger. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.